I came to Geneva to seek a fresh start in relations between the United States and the Soviet Union, and we have done this.
Mr. Reagan had been in Geneva for a couple of days before his counterpart arrived. Gorbachev arrived on Monday. There was a repeat of the pomp and ceremony that had greeted President Reagan. And like Mr. Reagan, General Secretary Gorbachev also had an airport statement. Gorbachev said that the first and foremost issue facing his meetings with Mr. Reagan was how to stop the arms race on Earth and how to stop it from spreading to space. President Reagan took the reference to his space-based missile defense system in stride.
If he feels as strongly that way as I do, then we'll end the arms race.
The first day of talks between the two leaders was Tuesday. While there had been hints of what would be discussed, White House spokesman Larry Speaks made it clear the details were under a news blackout.
Those who talk don't know what's going on, and those who know what's going on won't talk.
15 minutes had been scheduled for the initial session, but as Speaks pointed out later,
for the two of them to meet alone and exchange views for over 2 hours, and what, as I say, is clearly an unexpected development, does indicate that the two certainly have the ability to converse in a even tone, and they felt it was constructive that they continue at that in that method.
When the two broke for lunch, the Soviet leader spent about 45 minutes with the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
We met at the Soviet Union with Mr. Gorbachev himself, Mr. Dobrynin, and his key officials. We raised with him four very basic concerns.
They included an appeal for a comprehensive nuclear test ban and a system of verification. Jackson also pressed Gorbachev on the issue of Soviet Jews.
In effect, said that the Soviets, their Jews were Soviet citizens, and they are talented people, and they are great people. They make a lot of contributions, which is not the point. The point was about their treatment and immigration policies.
Our Moscow correspondent, Walter Rogers, says Gorbachev's meeting with Jackson was well thought out.
I think it's very clear that Mr. Gorbachev wanted to do some political poaching in Mr. Reagan's backyard, and so he met with a critic of Mr. Reagan, Jesse Jackson. Mr. Gorbachev was also out to make it very clear that he is ready to go to the mat with President Reagan on human rights and dissident issues in the United States, and he sees Jesse Jackson as an American dissident.
Following the meeting with Jackson, the Soviet leader and Mr. Reagan had another series of discussions. Then, as Larry Speaks told us, they asked their advisors to leave them alone.
They walked for about 5 minutes to a pool house, which is located just a few yards away from the shores of the lake, and went inside and sat before an open fireplace.
And so the Fireside Summit of 1985 was born. As the two world leaders talked, their wives met for the first time. Nancy Reagan said later,
we talked about our husbands and the meeting and what we both hoped would come out of the meeting.
Several anti-nuclear and human rights activists were in Geneva during the summit. And as ABC's Lisa Rowland told us, Mrs. Gorbachev ran into one of them.
Raisa Gorbachev's pleasant visit to Old Town Geneva was rudely shattered. As she left the Renaissance-style city hall, a Ukrainian heckler shouted angrily at her. In Russian, he cried out, "Free Sakharov, free political prisoners, the KGB are killers." Mrs. Gorbachev's smile rapidly faded as she was rushed into a waiting black limousine. Sirens began blaring as police cars escorted her away. At the same time, Swiss soldiers chased the Ukrainian dissident away.
There were a few incidents like that, but nothing serious. Day two of the summit saw the president and the general secretary meet alone again, except for their interpreters, and Larry Speaks seemed optimistic.
During the afternoon, good progress was made, but some work remains to be done.
And Gorbachev hinted that while the conversations were polite, neither man pulled any punches.
We have a very lively discussion of everything. You may be sure that the discussion is lively.
But friendly?
Дружественным.
духе откровенности, по-деловому, и я думаю, с чувством ответственности.
In a frank, businesslike, and I think responsible way.
All in all, Larry Speak said,
the president's frame of mind is very good. He will sleep well tonight.
Despite the news blackout on exactly what was being said, the free world had a pretty good idea of what the tone of the summit was. And as Greg Dobbs reported from Moscow, the Kremlin relaxed its usual tight rein on news coverage.
Two things happened here in Moscow today, both in connection with the summit and each for the first time ever. This morning, on the front page of the Communist Party paper Pravda, there was a photograph of President Reagan sitting with Mr. Gorbachev. Now, Reagan often is pictured here in the papers as a warmonger, usually in cartoon form, but never before has his photo simply been shown on a front page. And this afternoon on the television news, there was a story about Mrs. Gorbachev with Mrs. Reagan. Never before has any Soviet First Lady been shown in action apart from her husband. Now, much Soviet coverage of the summit has been typically rhetorical, but today anyway, not all. Greg Dobbs, ABC News, Moscow.
The summit ended officially on Thursday with a joint appearance by Messrs. Gorbachev and Reagan.
I leave Geneva today and our fireside summit determined to pursue every opportunity to build a safer world of peace and freedom.
Mr. Reagan then asked Mr. Gorbachev to help get the job done, adding, I'm sure you will. In his response, the Soviet leader got in another reference to the chief sticking point between the two countries, the so-called Star Wars initiative.
The Soviet Union, for its part, will do all it can in this cooperation with the United States of America in order to achieve practical results. To cut down the arms race, to cut down the arsenals which we've piled up, and produce the conditions which will be necessary for peace on Earth and in space.
And with that, the first summit meeting between the United States and the USSR since 1979 broke up. Mikhail Gorbachev left to brief the Warsaw Pact countries. President Reagan flew to Brussels to tell the NATO allies about his talks. Both men found general acceptance among other world leaders. Britain's Margaret Thatcher summed up the thinking of most.
I don't think you should underestimate the atmosphere of cordiality and confidence, but also the realism that there is a great deal more to be done. And I think it is this balance which I find so striking. The atmosphere is confident, but there's no euphoria or complacency.
From Brussels, it was on to Washington and to Capitol Hill. As President Reagan wound up an extremely long day by speaking to a joint session of Congress. An appearance, as you can hear, which was enthusiastically received.
Thank you. Members of the Congress.
Mr. Reagan told the packed House that he had found Mikhail Gorbachev to be an energetic defender of Soviet policy, an eloquent speaker, and a good listener.
It was a constructive meeting, so constructive, in fact, that I look forward to welcoming Mr. Gorbachev to the United States next year. And I have accepted his invitation to go to Moscow the following year.
No momentous agreements had been expected and none was reached at the summit, but Mr. Reagan said a start had been made.
We've concluded a new agreement designed to bring the best of America's artists and academics to the Soviet Union. The exhibits that will be included in this exchange are one of the most effective ways for the average Soviet citizen to learn about our way of life.
In addition to the cultural exchange, an important understanding was reached involving air travel.
We have also, together with the government of Japan, concluded a Pacific Air Safety Agreement with the Soviet Union. This is designed to set up cooperative measures to improve civil air safety in that region of the Pacific. What happened before must never be allowed to happen there again.
The reference there to the shooting down of a Korean jetliner by the Soviets in 1983, an incident which killed 269 people. The summit also produced an agreement involving commercial flights between the superpowers. It was announced on Friday by Charles Redman at the State Department.
The two sides have reached tentative agreement to resume regularly scheduled service between the United States and the Soviet Union.
U.S. flights to the USSR had stopped in 1978 when the routes became unprofitable. Soviet flights to the U.S. had been suspended in protest 4 years ago when Poland declared martial law. The Geneva summit gave both sides the chance to make strong commitments, even though specific ways of reaching the goals have yet to be worked out. For instance, on the issue of reducing nuclear weapons, Mr. Reagan told Congress,
specifically, we agreed in Geneva that each side should move to cut offensive nuclear arms by 50% in appropriate categories. In our joint statement, we called for early progress on this, turning the talks toward our chief goal, offensive reductions. We called for an interim accord on intermediate range nuclear forces, leading, I hope, to the complete elimination of this class of missiles.
As expected, neither Mr. Reagan nor Mr. Gorbachev gave an inch on the Star Wars issue, although the president said,
we're offering to permit Soviet experts to see firsthand that SDI does not involve offensive weapons. American scientists would be allowed to visit comparable facilities of the Soviet strategic defense program, which in fact has involved much more than research for many years.
The trick now is to come up with some way of verifying agreements if and when they are reached. Georgi Arbatov says if on-site inspections are needed, then that's okay. Arbatov, who is a close advisor of Mikhail Gorbachev, put it this way.
You are good guys, but we cannot trust you just on your words. And you also don't trust us on our words. I can assure you that we are good then.
The distrust that has marked U.S.-Soviet relations for years isn't about to vanish overnight because two men talked for 2 days in a European city. But as House Democratic leader Jim Wright points out,
we're closer, if by mere inches, to world peace than we were a year ago. And we're closer than we were a week ago.
And as President Reagan said during his broadcast address to Congress Thursday night, getting closer to world peace was what the summit was all about.
We met as we had to meet. I called for a fresh start, and we made that start. I can't claim that we had a meeting of the minds on such fundamentals as ideology or national purpose, but we understand each other better, and that's a key to peace.
The key to peace in the Middle East is still under the doormat. As you can hear, some of the heaviest fighting in recent months took place in Beirut this past week. It came as the Archbishop of Canterbury's envoy, Terry Waite, was in Beirut to try to arrange the release of four Americans held hostage by Muslim extremists. ABC's Julie Flint was among reporters waiting to hear what progress Waite had made when the shooting broke out.
This fighting has prevented Terry Waite from crossing the street from the Associated Press office to the Commodore Hotel here to hold a promised news conference. The fighting is between Shiite Muslim and Druze militiamen and concerns the dispute over the Lebanese flag, which Druze militiamen have been tearing down.
When Waite got pinned down, correspondent Flint dodged bullets to make it to his hotel, where she asked him how the efforts to free the hostages were going.
The situation, of course, here is very difficult and also extremely dangerous, as you can hear from the gunfire around as we give this interview. But it's not impossible to make progress, and progress has been made in the past week.
Specifically, Waite said he had a couple of meetings with the people who are holding the four Americans. He says a good measure of mutual trust has been established with them, and his message to the families of the four hostages is, don't give up hope. Waite was largely responsible for getting another hostage, the Reverend Benjamin Weir, freed last September. That family's joy since then was clouded by grief this week with word from Egypt that one of Reverend Weir's daughters had been killed in a traffic accident. Ann Weir was 24, was a teacher at the American school in Alexandria. Five Palestinians accused in the hijacking of the cruise ship Achille Lauro were convicted in Italy this week of gun and explosives possession. Four of the Palestinians got prison terms of from 4 to 8 years. ABC's David Enzor tells us about the fate of their accomplice.
Their stiffest sentence went to a fifth man who did not help hijack the ship, but helped in the crime this first trial was about, which was smuggling machine guns and hand grenades into Italy. He got a 9-year sentence. It turns out that his name, real name, is Mohammed Isa Abbas, and he's a remote cousin of the Mohammed Abu Abbas, who the U.S. says was the mastermind of the whole episode.
The five Palestinians still face trial for the actual hijacking of the Achille Lauro and for the murder of Leon Klinghoffer, the elderly wheelchair-bound American tourist on board the cruise ship. At the time of the hijacking of TWA Flight 847 last June, U.S. officials had said they were pretty sure of the identities of the people involved. This past week, Attorney General Edwin Meese announced that a federal grand jury in Washington had indicted three men believed responsible for that hijacking. An American Navy diver, Robert Steedham, was murdered during the takeover. New Zealand's highest-ranking judge this week sentenced two French secret agents to 10 years in prison for manslaughter in last July's bombing of the Greenpeace ship Rainbow Warrior. A crewman died in the explosion. ABC's John Shrapnel in Wellington says an official of the environmental group is not pleased with what he considers to be the light sentence.
Greenpeace International Director David McTaggart was at the court and he says he's bitterly disappointed. He says the other French agents responsible for the Rainbow Warrior bombing and the former French Defense Minister Charles Ernoux should have been on trial too. McTaggart says Captain Dominique Prieur and Major Alain Maffar were both underwater experts and they knew what they were doing.
Correspondent Shrapnel says the sentences are to be served concurrently, which means the French agents will be eligible for parole in 5 years. Bob Wilcox of Dauphin Island, Alabama, shared the thoughts of many Gulf Coast residents this week.
There's no way there should be a hurricane this late. Not this late in the year at all.
Maybe not, but there it was, Hurricane Kate, the first November hurricane to come ashore in the U.S. in 50 years. After whipping Cuba with its 100-mile-an-hour winds, Kate aimed for the Florida Panhandle and the area around Panama City.
The eye passed about 25 miles east of us. We sustained quite a bit of property damage, structure damage. The storm surge from the Gulf and the rising tides have washed away the foundation of quite a few buildings, homes, and some motels.
Thousands evacuated their homes. April and James Boyette tried to, but got stuck in their car.
It was scary. The wind just shook the car like anything. I asked James, I hope this thing's got good brakes, so that wind's going to start pushing it.
More than a dozen people died as a result of Hurricane Kate. The storm eventually blew itself out in Georgia and the Carolinas after soaking everything in its path with heavy rain. They were still looking for the survivors of last week's volcano eruption in Colombia. And while some were rescued, indications were that the estimate of 25,000 dead would hold. We'll never know for sure, since so many people were buried under tons of mud and volcanic ash. ABC Sarita Kendall visited a hospital in Bogota, where a 12-year-old girl told her how she survived.
She and her family, brothers and sisters, were carried away by the mud avalanche on Wednesday night. She wiped the mud off her face, swam to the surface, and managed to cling onto a post until she was saved by a helicopter.
Meantime, officials were keeping a close watch on the Nevado del Ruiz volcano for signs that it might erupt again. There were three more arrests for spying this past week. The latest series began Thursday.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation announced today the arrest of Jonathan J. Pollard, age 31, a civilian employee of the U.S. Navy, on charges of retention of classified documents and theft of government property.
The FBI said that Pollard was passing those documents to the government of Israel, which said it knew nothing about it. A day later, Pollard's wife, Ann, was arrested and charged with unauthorized possession of classified documents. The third arrest involved a retired CIA employee, Larry Wu Tai Chin, whom the FBI says passed classified CIA documents to the People's Republic of China. The arrest came in a week which saw a Pentagon commission recommend that the number of people with security clearances be sharply reduced. A Texas state jury this week made a Texas-sized award ruling that Texaco must pay the Pennzoil Company $10.5 billion, that's with a B, dollars, in damages. The jury decided that Texaco interfered with Pennzoil's proposed merger with Getty Oil in 1984. Texaco went on to acquire Getty. Bob Harper's with Pennzoil.
We were attempting to acquire 3/7 of Getty Oil Company, and as we explained to the jury, that represented equivalent barrels of oil that was worth approximately $7.5 billion. And it deprived us of that right.
Texaco's Gordon Hamilton says his company will appeal.
In Texaco's opinion, there was no legal basis for the suit, and the overwhelming weight of the evidence was contrary to the jury's findings.
Analysts close to the case don't think the $10.5 billion award will stand. Baseball's last two big awards of the 1985 season were made this past week, and the New York Yankees figured prominently in both. In 1981, they traded away a speedy outfielder named Willie McGee for a pitcher named Bob Sykes. We haven't heard much about Sykes, but Willie McGee, who patrolled center for the Cardinals, was named this year's most valuable player in the National League. McGee's .353 batting average set a league record for the highest average for a switch hitter. He was also first in the number of base hits. The American League MVP award went to Yankees first baseman Don Mattingly, who beat out George Brett of the Royals and fellow Yankee Ricky Henderson in the balloting.
I thought it would be a little closer, but I like the company I'm in there at least. George Brett's and Ricky Henderson's, you really can't go wrong.
Mattingly led both leagues in runs batted in with 145, in doubles with 48, and he was the best fielding first baseman in the American League. Not bad for a guy who's played only two seasons in the big leagues. And those are the people and stories that made world news this week. World News This Week was written and produced by Gil Longen. Engineering by Cy Kantrowitz and Dan Krowitzky. I'm John Grimes, ABC News, New York. World News This Week is a presentation of ABC News.